There it goes.
Okay.
I think it's going to work. We're going to leave it like that. Good. Okay. I put the word mathematics in brackets. If you're not a mathematician, actually, I believe that everybody in this room is a mathematician. It's just you have chosen not to use your powers in mathematics, but you could. So, but in any case, if mathematics is not your field, that's okay, but I am going to try to ground some of the things I'm saying in some discipline, and mathematics is the one that I know something about. So I will be using some mathematics. Now, two things that's true in every session I do. The first one is, everything that is said in this room, by me, by you, is a conjecture. We say things in order to hear them and say, oh no, that's not what I meant something else. So conjecturing is about saying in order to hear and then modify what I thought I was thinking. Is that all right? It's particularly the case that anything that I say is a conjecture. You must test it in your own experience. You must not believe anything that I say. It's very dangerous. Is that right? That's critical thinking. You must use critical thinking about everything that I say, and I would argue that other people say that that's a different matter. The second thing is that the slides, I will make sure that they're here electronically. Don't try to copy down lists of things on this, they're just words. What you get mostly from this session is what happens inside you as you think about and apply what is being said to your context. Is that fair? I work phenomenologically, which is a word that's really hard to say. You have to take a run at it. And it's taken me a long time to learn to say it. Phenomenologically, which simply means testing things in your own experience. I'm interested in the lived experience of students. What is it actually like to be learning mathematics? Okay? Good. Now, let's see what happens. I think if it's all right, I'm going to just move this chair. Otherwise, I'll trip over it. Okay. I'm afraid some of the slides haven't had as much time put to them as they, because I only really worked on it the last couple of days, so I apologize for this, because the beginning of it is this. Critical thinking. Attending to what is critical, I'm going to take it to mean attending to what is critical in teaching. Alright? Question is, what is it that's critical in teaching? What is it that really matters? I apologize, and one of the other meanings for critical is finding fault with something. Somebody's critical of your teaching or of what you said or something, so on. But I prefer, rather than finding fault, critical thinking is about looking for room for improvement. Right, so I like always try to put the positive side on, not the negative. Is that all right? So that's sort of how I'm taking critical thinking to be. And then teaching, because there's critical thinking in teaching. Oh, yes, one thing I should say, if at any time you're not sure what I'm saying, or you have a question, just wave at me. Or squeak. That's fine. And we'll stop. Yeah, good. Okay. I see teaching as a sequence of acts. The teacher does things. Hopefully, in response to and in concert with the students. And so I say that teaching takes place in time. You can actually video a teacher teaching. Can you video a learner learning? I don't think so. Because learning takes place, for me, over time. It's a maturation process. The tougher version of this, which Caleb Gattegno, he was, I think he was of Egyptian descent. I can't remember exactly where he was born. It might have been Egypt. He spent a lot of time in the UK, then he went to the United States. He developed a way of teaching languages without the teacher speaking the language. I've been in classes where I was taught, just for an hour, for 2 hours, Armenian by someone whose grandmother and parents spoke Armenian, but he didn't. He couldn't speak Armenian, but he knew what it should sound like. And he got us to make the sounds and then choreographed our sound making into words that made sense. So this is called the silent way. Gattegno also wrote a lot about mathematics education, and one of his many claims, he wrote about education generally. Let's get back to learning. Learning, he said, takes place when you're asleep. Sleep is when we forget what is not needed, leaving us with what is needed. Trouble is, some kids, when they go to sleep, they forget the bits that we want them to hang on to. Have you ever met any students who you've taught them how to add fractions, and then 6 weeks later, more adding fractions, and they don't know how to do it? Yeah? Not only 6 weeks, but next year, and the year after. And so in the UK, we teach adding of fractions, you know, for whole year after year, hoping that eventually something will catch on. Well, that's just not good enough. Just not good enough.
No wonder for them to be spending the teaching.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
Learning.
So learning takes place over time. So that leads me to the question, which acts of teaching are critical? Well, the situation we're in is very complicated. Human beings are complicated things to deal with, aren't they? Anybody had any trouble dealing with another human being?
20 years.
Many years. Yeah. It's amazing how people do things you don't expect them to do. One of my ways of putting this is cause and effect is terrific as a mechanism for understanding the material world. I pick something up, I let go, it falls. There's cause and effect. And physics is about studying that, chemistry, and so on. But human beings are not objects. Human beings have all sorts of dimensions to them, including a spiritual dimension, which needs to be taken into account. So, to say the obvious, teaching and learning are both very complex actions. And I think that teaching should be classified with a number of others as caring professions. Now, you can think of teaching as, I know this, I go into a room, I say this to people, and then I walk out again and I've done my teaching. That's not teaching. That's just going into a room and talking, and then coming back out again. Right? Teaching, now here I'm going to use the word mathematics, but you can substitute anything you like. Teaching is a caring profession because you need to care for the students. And not just that you care secretly, but you hold it all in. But there's evidence that you care about the progress of your students. It makes a huge difference when that takes place. And the other side of it is caring for your subject. In my case, mathematics. So it's quite easy, and we have reports of people doing this, where they care for the students so completely that they don't actually do any mathematics. The mathematics becomes trivial. And we know, of course, of classes where people care for the mathematics so dominantly that they don't really pay much attention to what's happening to the students. Am I making sense here? Are you recognizing the sort of thing I'm saying? And so for me, it's about balancing these two and displaying this care, displaying it mathematically in your subject or in your discipline, and displaying it affectively. Okay. So what are some of the critical factors in teaching? Well, I think if we were under slightly different circumstances, I would get you to make a list of what you think. But because I'm just sort of coming in and talking and then the session will be over, I'm going to show you the list that I made, thinking about it over a few days. So I'm not claiming there's anything clever here. There's the educational and the socioeconomic background of the students. So that the people who arrive in the classroom, what is their experience? How do they feel about their mathematics or about their science or about their psychology or whatever it is they've been studying? Then there's the institutional context, the demands of the institution, lots of assignments perhaps, specific curriculum to study. I know in the case of some of the students here in the past, it's been the case that they have to pass a subject in order to get their degree, even though they've already done all the courses that are supposed to depend on that subject, in that course. Been there, done that. So you have to ask yourself, hang on, what's going on? The dispositions of both the students and the teachers. How are they disposed to act? What are their habits? When they come into the first mathematics class or the first physics class or the first history class, whatever it is, what are they expecting? What is their past experience leading them to do quite naturally? For example, are they disposed to do lots of practice examples because that's how you learn? Are they disposed to memorize some formulae and think that if they've memorized things, then they've done their task? What is it? And of course, the disposition of the teacher and the students interact in a complex way. Am I making sense here? But if not, we can stop. Anybody unhappy? No? Okay. Good. Everybody's happy. Well, it doesn't follow. Just because I'm not unhappy doesn't mean I'm happy. I can be tolerant. People in this part of the world are very gracious. I know this from experience. So. Okay. Beliefs. The kinds of beliefs that the students and the teacher and the institution indeed have about what learning is about. The attitudes. I have an alphabet that starts attitudes, beliefs, confidences maybe, confidence. I can't remember them all now, but I've actually worked out all the way from A to Z. I think I skipped one letter because it was too hard. But an alphabet of attitudes and beliefs. There's like a very complex human psyche going on here. I hope. I can't remember whether I'm going to get to that or not. We'll see. And then there's what teachers actually do and how they do it in the classroom. And that's sort of the area that I want to start to direct your attention to. What the teachers actually do and how they do it in the classroom. And I reckon that's a really critical factor. Now I'm going to just mention mathematics again. When I say mathematics, you have to hear whatever it is you think about. Sorry, Paul, forget that one. That's not there. But the teacher and the text act as a role model for student experience. The way the text is structured and the way the teacher works with and on what's in the text provides the students with what they think the subject is about. What other experience do they have? When I was growing up sort of heading for university, my parents' friends used to say to me, what does it mean to do mathematics at university? More arithmetic. That's meant to be a joke. Mathematics at university is not fancy arithmetic. Am I making sense? So if you're a historian, doing history at school tends to be about learning about the past, but history at university is about interrogating original sources and secondary sources and comparing and contrasting and so on. It's quite a different discipline. So the impressions that people come to come about from the teachers they have and the textbooks they have. So how, from the text and from the teacher, you pick up how mathematics is learned and done, or whatever subject it is, and what mathematics is about and what it's for. And so I like this little slogan. I have lots of slogans. I have a very small brain, so I need to remember things, so I have slogans that help me remember it. And this is one of them. I think it's important for the teacher to be mathematical or to be historical or to be a technologist or whatever is the subject, being mathematical both with the students as well as in front of them, displaying what it looks like to think mathematically, as well as provoking the students to think mathematically. Okay, I'm going to give you some examples of this. So this leads me to a topic which I've... I don't know why this is happening, but anyway. Okay, I do know why it's happening. That's not there. Forget that for the moment. This leads me to a topic that I've been working on for 25 years, and I'm still working on, and I only understand a little bit, maybe, if anything, and that is attention. Because for me, a lot of things boil down to what are students attending to? And I'm going to give you some examples of this in just a minute. What are students actually attending to? And what am I attending to, and are they the same thing? So for example, what you're attending to right now is not what I'm attending to. Right? You're attending to what I've said, I'm attending to what I'm going to say. So already they're different. I'm trying to pay attention to the sorts of things that are coming, and what I'm going to do, which tasks I'm going to offer you. And you're trying to make sense of what I'm saying in relation to, hopefully, the title, which is critical thinking. We'll get to the scientific reasoning rather later. But for me, the question is not just what am I attending to, but how am I attending to it? In what way? And, of course, then you have the question of how are the students attending? And certainly in mathematics, this is another one of my slogans, a session without an opportunity for learners to generalize is not a mathematics lesson. It's a lesson in being a clerk, copying things down, memorizing, and then regurgitating. And so I'm going to give you some examples of this. Now, this one is mathematical, but it's from high school, so I hope it's not too, off-putting. This is a page out of a Singapore textbook that I encountered last week, something like that.
Similar to Malaysian.
Well, I thought it was. Yes. I thought that might be the case. Okay. Now, typical homework task. I've been told that in Singapore, the textbooks in secondary are used mostly for the exercises.
Certainly, it depends
whether you want to call this problem solving or not. For me, this is not problem solving. This is dealing with, this is dealing with the teacher, which is a different kind of problem. Let me just tell you this. When my daughter was quite young, from about the age of about 6, 7, through until certainly high school, within 2 weeks of the beginning of term, beginning of the year, she could mimic each one of her teachers. Well, she could display behavior which wasn't natural to her, so I assumed was the various teachers. Now, what was she attending to in class?
Behavior.
Because it's vital that the teacher knows, that the students know if the teacher comes in like this, then there's trouble, whatever it is. They need to know the signs of when the teacher's in a good mood or a bad mood. And of course, it doesn't apply at university.
Maybe.
Remember, everything I said is a conjecture. Tested in your experience. Very quickly, a lot of the students. Another example of this, and the way I got onto this topic, was for years, in fact, it's still true, I do workshops in England, maybe a couple hundred hours worth of workshops every year. At the end of every session, somebody used to come up to me and say, and they still do quite often, "Where's your accent from?" I don't know if you know, but people for whom English is, they claim it's a first language, they like to know which part of the world you learned it in.
And so Irish people come up to me frequently and they say, "And what part of Ireland are you from?" And the answer is, "I'm not from Ireland." And so I finally worked out from this question that what students are attending to really matters, because I'm busy thinking about mathematics and they're busy looking at paying attention to my accent. I had a lecturer at university once and we watched over a year as his shoes fell apart further and further. They started off with holes on the bottom and by the end they were actually just falling apart. We kept wondering, when will he come in with a new pair of shoes? You wouldn't do that here. Okay, so standard classic homework. Would you please do exercise 1 on page, exercise 5A, number 1 for homework. Yes? Recognize the sort of thing.
Yes.
I used to be told, do the odd-numbered exercises for homework. So the teacher picks out some of them, odd numbers, that makes it easy. Actually, some of the textbooks, the odd-numbered ones, didn't have the answers in the back. Okay. What I want to suggest to you is that there's a different way of using exercises. And this all comes about by thinking about attention. Now, whether this applies to history or physics or chemistry or engineering, that's an open question. I'm not responsible for that one. I know a little bit about mathematics. That's all I know. But this is classic. You can find it anywhere in the world. Okay. So classic homework, do all the questions. Now, do you know how your students actually do these? Some of you have mathematical background. How did you do these questions when you were young? Did you do the... Sorry? I didn't hear, sir.
Were you a substitution method or elimination method?
Yes. Well, the next page has got elimination methods. But when I say how, I mean, did you do question A, then B, then C, then D, then E, then F?
Depends on
did
the student.
Did you ever take a...
If the student is very
helpful,
maybe can do
finish. But did you ever take a break?
No.
In between? What do you think happens now? They do A, then they text somebody.
Yes.
Then they do B, then they look up on the internet something. Then they do C, and they type bored and send it off to all their friends. You recognize what I'm talking about?
Yes.
But what does the author think the student is doing with these? Can I make a suggestion? Let us consider what is the same and what is different about this, just this set here. What's the same and what's different about these questions? You don't need to know any mathematics to do this bit, because you can recognize symbols and numbers. So what is the same and what is different? There are X's and there are Y's. Let's get rid of the tricky bit. There's an equal sign in each one of them too. Yeah, give you that for free. Okay. Always get in with the hard stuff first. Okay. So there are X's and there are Y's and there are equal signs. What about the structure? Could you just talk to somebody beside you? What are you seeing that's the same and what's different? Just talk to somebody very quickly, please. What I want to suggest is that you were using your attention differently from the way you would have if you were doing these for homework. But what I just asked you to do is much more likely to be what the author wanted you to do. The author isn't expecting you simply to get the answers, because the author already knows the answers. That isn't the challenge. But it's what is the same and what's changing, what is permitted to change and what has to be the same in order, what constitutes the substitution method. So, can I suggest that in almost all of them, that one doesn't. And then these two have got that and that. So here you're told y in terms of x, and so that's a way of,
that's really the essence of substitution.
Here you're told that these two things, are basically you're told that is something, so you could substitute that in for this. So really this is the same as this. The letters are backwards, but the 3 isn't playing any role because there's 3x, 3x. That's what you're trying to get the student to recognize.
So if you have a student who goes into an examination and looks at a question, you want them to be able to detect immediately which method is the most appropriate. Now, one of the ways of bringing this about is by doing lots and lots and lots. But I don't think it's very efficient. I think it's good for getting the speed up, but it's not efficient in terms of learning.
In terms of learning, the question is, what is it that makes this? What's the same about all of these that makes it substitution? The substitution is an appropriate thing to do. In each case, you've got to quickly isolate something and then pop it in for the other. Pardon the intensity of the technical mathematical term there, pop. Okay. So the same sorts of thing applies to other exercises.
Asking yourself, what is the same, what is different, what is allowed to change, and still it remains an example of this type. So an alternative way of addressing these exercises is to say, for homework, is to respond to the question, do as many of these as you need to do so that you can tell me how to do a question of this type. Because that's what you really want students to be able to do, isn't it? And if you simply said it as, do all of them, their attention might be all over the place. What you want them to be attending to is the relationships amongst them. And then when they come into class, you can do things like, make up an example of this type for yourself. Make up and do. Or make up and do a really easy question of this type. How about y equals 3 and x equals 4? Pretty easy. And then ask them to make up a hard question of this type. It's the working on the type, and that's what I'm talking about here, is the shift from the particular, doing these questions, to equipping myself to do any question of this type. And that's what we want to achieve. Is it not? Now, what has this got to do with critical, being, you know, critical, whatever I called it, I've forgotten already, working critically on teaching? It's asking myself, what is a critical element in learning how to do, in this case, solving linear equations? And what's critical is having a sense of the generality, the class of objects that can be done by substitution. Not just getting answers to the particulars. Please, yes.
Just one thing to very simple question.
Yes.
From this kind of practice, what is your perspective comparing between Asian philosophy of mathematics education to compare with what the UK already does? Is it similar like this one?
We have these sorts of exercises in the textbooks, yes, and people are asked to do them, yes. But there are significant groups of teachers who are trying to work, what I call working on the exercises, rather than working through them, one after the other. So I use, again, it's one of these slogans, working through to me means doing one, and having a drink, then doing another, then having a snack, then doing another one, and texting, or you know, whatever. And just doing them one after the other, accumulating the answers. Now, of course it's the case, particularly, well, many of the students who come to UTM have succeeded in not just doing working through, but have somehow internalized the working on and come to recognize it. They don't need the support. But what I'm always concerned, not about the students who succeed naturally, but the students who struggle. Because I reckon I'm a bit of a struggler. And I've always been worried about myself and other people like me. Please.
My problem is, you suppose what are the same, what are the differences?
Yes.
And if I want to teach this one, what are the same, what are the differences? And based on this, I want to teach the students how they can solve this question by using similarity.
Yes.
My problem, why are we doing this for summer? First, we teach them to catch this. Linear equation. We have two linear equations.
Yes.
We want to know what way and when they are clustered. After that, maybe I think we focus on sketching and some visualization.
Yes.
After focus, because when we say what are the difference, we just focus on symbolic work.
Yes. I agree fully. I'm taking this exercise out of a textbook. Graphing came later. That's not my problem. That's not my problem. I mean, yes, we want to make students, want to get students to make connections between these symbols and graphs and possibly tables of value, although I'm not so strong on tables of value. My wife calls them tables of no value. And I agree with her. So,
but there are some educationists who think that by giving students experience, and that's how students can actually internalize.
Will internalize.
The,
well, I think
whatever the method or whatever technique is good.
Yeah. I think there's a missing element there.
The Kumon method really believes in it.
Yes.
It's how they teach the students using the Kumon method. Pages and pages of exercise.
Right. And I'm afraid I haven't got slides for this bit included here. I can search them out if we need them. But I want to say two things there. Let me just get it. I've forgotten one of them already. Anyway, in mathematics, before I forget, in mathematics, I'm speaking about mathematics now, I apologize, but that's what I know about. The teacher gives students tasks, might be do these exercises, or it might be sketch graphs, or whatever. The teacher gives students tasks. What is the purpose of the task? The task is to produce activity by the students. Now, in a lot of England and in North America, they glue those two things together, task and activity. So I give you an activity. Excuse me, I can't give you an activity. You engage in activity if I offer a task, or you make your own task. So task produces activity. Are we making sense so far? The task at university is often sit in the lecture. The activity is to make notes and to try to make sense of what the lecturer is saying. So it still applies to every subject. The task produces activity. What's the point of activity?
Experience.
Somehow we want to get some we want to have an experience. But there's a problem. And this is another of my slogans. This turns out to come from Immanuel Kant and Hume. But I didn't know that at the time. One of the things that we don't seem to learn from experience is that we don't often learn from experience alone. Just because I've experienced something doesn't mean I learn from it. Have you ever said to yourself, I'll never do that again? Yeah? And guess what? Within a week, done it again. Is that learning from experience? Certainly not. Kids have lots of experience in school. People in lectures and in a university have lots of experiences. Many of them outside of the classroom. There's all sorts of stuff happening for people. So I want to add, and this is why I want to add, okay, that the task. Activity, experience, reflection on experience. withdraw from the action and ask yourself, what was effective, what was not effective? Now, there are more actions you can take, and I guess because of the topic, I ought to go in that direction, but let's just make sure we've grasped this bit. Task, activity, experience. I think the teacher can do two things, and only two things. One of the things the teacher cannot do is do the learning for the teacher, for the students. I cannot learn for the students, do the learning for them. They have to do that. That's because human beings are human beings. They're willful agents. They're not bottles that fall over when you hit them. The cause and effect doesn't work in education. Okay. So the two things that I think a teacher can do, I mean, obviously there are many, but two principal things. One of them is they can direct attention where it seems appropriate. So for example, I want to direct attention to the presence of Y and Y, 2X and 2X, 3X and 3X, the repetition there. That's where I want attention to be, at least initially on substitution. Just lost the second one. I can direct attention, and I can provoke the student to pull out of what the activity and to become aware of what they have been doing. I can promote attention to the action that's been engaged in. Have you ever come across students? Have you ever come across students where you give them a task? They immediately start doing something they can think of doing.
Yeah.
You recognize that? Well, they've been trained to do it because they've been memorizing techniques. It's the first technique that pops into their head, they try and do it. Okay. Is that an efficient way to go through life? I don't think so. I think what's efficient and actually desirable is to say to yourself, okay, I've got something I could do, now let's see if there's something better that I could do. Let's see if there's an alternative procedure or action that I could carry out. And that applies not just in mathematics, but in life. I don't know much about youth culture in this part of the world, but in the UK it is certainly the case that we have a lot of adolescents who react to whatever happens to them around them. They don't say to themselves, if I follow those people and do what they're doing, what will the consequences be for me? Am I making sense there?
Yes,
it's about learning that every action has consequences. And I wish that the English government, the UK government, would take that into account. We have the track record for the shortest time between a government announcement of a policy and unintended consequences. It's about 24 hours. Incredible. People don't think things through. And they tell us, well, okay, we'll get everybody doing this. And then, oh my heavens, we never thought that would happen. It's the unintended consequences. And in mathematics, well, I guess other subjects, we can work with students on that in mathematics in the hope that they pick it up as something that actually applies to them, to their emotions and other places. So not allowing your emotions to drive your behavior is something that adolescents really need to learn. In some parts of the world, you know, obviously I've not all that experienced here. How are we doing? We haven't got very far, so I need to find out what's possible here. I can't see. Oh yes, okay. So this is just a little bit of cultural support for my notion that generalization is really what mathematics learning is about, and I would suggest that's true in every subject. In every subject we generalize differently. To be able to deduce and then to generalize, that's the mark of an intelligent person. If you cannot generalize, you have not learned well enough. That's a translation from the Chinese. I make no claims. It certainly wasn't me, so I just hope it's a reasonable translation. And then from the Roman Seneca, long is the way to learning by rules, short and effective by examples. But the problem is, I think, it's not just the examples, it's how you work on the examples that really matters. I think Seneca missed that bit. It's not just the fact of examples, it's how you work on them. So what I'm trying to illustrate here, let me just pull back from the action a little bit. What I'm trying to illustrate here is how a critical feature of teaching and learning comes to mind, namely, what are people attending to? And as I probe that question, I find myself working on these sorts of things. What are they attending to when they're looking at a page? When they're looking at a diagram, even, a graph? What are they attending to? And how can I get them to attend in the way that I'm attending, and not necessarily in the way that they're currently attending? Okay, I guess just... Now, one of the things that I'm supposed to be doing at the moment is writing a book on attention with my wife, Anne Watson, who is professor of maths education at Oxford. And one of the things that she's been working on is a sort of... there's global attention and there's fine details of attention, which we'll come to in just a minute, and then there's a sort of attention in the middle. And this is to do with ways of thinking. So somewhere between primary and secondary, kids need to move from thinking about discrete to allowing to also think about the continuous, the gradually changing. So one can ask oneself, what are the sort of centers of gravity, the principal concerns in my discipline at any age level, or any, so for example at university. I have a list of some of these, just a few of them. Very young kids can recognize that change is taking place, but they don't necessarily know to look for cause and effect, seeking the causes of those changes. So that's something that's important for scientific thinking, even if it doesn't help us enormously in education. Because whenever here's a wild conjecture for you. In education, if you think that something has caused something else, I'm willing to bet that you've missed something. Because there are more things going on than just this causes that. So I teach a little bit differently, the students do a little bit better, but there's more going on than just the fact of my change. Just the way I'm doing it, there's all sorts of things that could be going on. Kids have to move from from the empirical to the structural, from looking for relationships amongst things rather than just looking for patterns in things. The Russians, Davidoff, would actually argue that human beings start with the structural and then go empirical later, but that's another exercise. Okay, there's a list of those, but I don't think that interests us right at the moment, so I'm going to jump ahead. Okay, yes, good. Here's another example of about placing attention in mathematics. It's not all that difficult, so let's see what happens. I want to propose that arithmetic is the study of structural relationships. It's not the doing of calculations. Arithmetic as calculation is a technical matter. Well, I remember the other thing I was going to say earlier. I'll try and bring it in again. Okay, so arithmetic is not the getting of answers to 3 plus 5 for me. It's the relationship, 3, 5, and 8 is what actually matters. I want to propose that thinking like that at any level is something which is again taking the notion of critical teaching, looking for what is critical in teaching and learning. Namely, how is it you want the students to be thinking? And then trying to produce that. Getting answers to questions is simply about passing exams. So another way of thinking of that is arithmetic is the study of actions on objects. So here's a question for you. I promise you, anybody who's got through primary school can do this. So take a big breath and feel confident. What action undoes the action of adding 3? Subtracting 3. Well, you said subtracting 3. I noticed the little rise at the end. That's a question mark. Okay. I would like to hear subtracting 3. The falling cadence is different from the rising cadence. Yeah? No. Thank you for doing that. Look, but you see, this is something about it's critical in listening to students. It isn't just what they say, but it's how they say it. It reveals quite a bit about where they are. And furthermore, most of the time, students don't make sense. Well, neither do lecturers, if you actually listen. But, for example, it's well known that I have probably not completed a single sentence in talking. When we're talking, we don't speak in sentences. It's only when we write. Now, we have this notion of babbling, where students are trying to use technical terms in an appropriate way, but it doesn't quite come out right. And so it's, for the teacher, it's a matter of listening behind that. So that's another example of taking something that's critical in teaching and learning and putting attention to it and investigating. So what am I listening to? What am I hearing when students are speaking to me? Okay, so you're happy with... Anybody unhappy about... to undo adding three, you subtract three. Okay, that's the level at which I'm talking. Okay? Good. How about subtracting four? How do I undo subtracting four? Come on, let's hear everybody say it. What is it? Adding four. And I've got the four. That's good. Okay, terrific. Now how about this one? Adding three, then subtracting four. How do you undo that? Don't do the arithmetic. Undo the action. Adding four and then subtracting three. And you undo it in the opposite order. Yes? Well, that's really important. But do kids attend to that? No, mostly their attention is on adding three, subtracting four, take away one. Try to get the answer. But here it's paying attention to the action. Okay, here this is a bit tricky, I warn you. Subtracting from seven. Subtracting from seven. Adding to seven is a great conjecture. Any other conjectures?
Adding to make it seven.
Adding to negative seven.
To make it
to
seven.
Adding to make it seven. So if the idea is this, I've got a secret number. I'll tell you what it is, it's two. But it's secret. You don't know it. And I've subtracted it from seven, so my answer is five. Yes? So I tell you five, and your job is to work out what was my secret number. I subtract it from seven. So subtracting from seven is its own undoing. You do it twice, it ends up not moving. There's an invariance. That's a major mathematical theme. Great. Okay. Did you enjoy that? Okay. Let's try another one. What action undoes the action of multiplying by three? Dividing by... Oh, great! That's terrific! We've got some confidence. Okay, question. What has happened? When I first came into this room, it was quite hard to be getting response. And somehow we've got to the point where quite a few people were willing to say quite loudly, dividing by three. Am I right? So what's happened? What's happened? It's something for you to think about. I would like to think that I have exhibited something about caring for you and your thinking, and caring about mathematics. But there's also a lot of other stuff going on in the social relationship that we might have. I've tried to show myself as not somebody to be frightened of, for example. I don't fight. Okay, let's do dividing by four. Multiplying by four. Well done, yes. Some people have got their hands over their mouths just in case, but that's okay. Okay, how about multiplying by three, then dividing by four? Terrific! You've just shown me how to divide fractions. Now, if you wanted to name something that's difficult in fractions, one of them is adding fractions, the other one is dividing by fractions. Most people memorize a rule. What's the rule? Turn it upside down, multiply. But most primary teachers that I talk to don't actually have an explanation. This is the explanation. Watch. Oh, sorry, let's forget that one for the moment. What undoes multiplying by three quarters? Dividing by three quarters. That's undoing multiplying is dividing. Dividing by three quarters. But what else is it? Well, multiplying by three quarters is multiplying by three and dividing by four. So what undoes multiplying by three and dividing by four? Multiplying by four and dividing by three. So how do you divide by three quarters? You multiply by four and you divide by three. It's a structural relationship. It's not something you memorize. It's something that you feel in your body and in your heart, and then it comes out in words. This one's a little bit tricky. Dividing 12 by. What undoes dividing 12 by? I've got a secret number. It's 2. Actually, Anne says never use 2 as an example, so I'll make it 3. Okay, I've got a secret number, it's 3. I divide 12 by 3, I get? 4. Yes? Okay, now you know 4, your job is to recover 3. How do you recover 3 from my 4? Divide 12 by 4. So divide 12 by is self-invariant, it undoes itself. And there are other things in mathematics that are like that. Great. Okay. Now I'm in a bit of trouble because I don't know what's coming next. Oh, yes. I'm going to use this to move into attention. So, how are we doing for time? No, good. Got half an hour?
Until
11:30. 11:30. That's what I thought. I just checking. I'm going to do one more mathematical task and then I'll see where we are. You okay? Just for a moment, what were you doing? I think you started off, you gazed at it, you saw there were a whole bunch of numbers, and you turned away. I watched lots of you. And your heads went
that way.
Yeah, don't want this. But then I suggested that maybe it's worth attending to. And so many of you put your heads back again. Now the question is, what are you doing? You see, if I can't answer this question, then what am I doing in a lecture? What am I doing when I'm teaching in a high school? If I don't know what the students are doing, how can I help them do something useful? You see my dilemma? Okay, and so let me stand back from the action for a moment. This is an example of picking up a feature that seems to be critical in teaching and learning, and using scientific reasoning, using experience to probe, to use the literature, to probe more deeply into what might be going on. Is that making sense? I can't tell from your response whether it's making sense or not. Not making sense? Am I not making sense? So, please. I would be very happy. I'd be even happier if you repeated, but okay. I'm just trying to withdraw from the action for a moment and to say, this is an example of detecting a feature of teaching and learning which looks as though it might be critical to how teaching and learning takes place effectively. Namely, what are people attending to? Okay? And I've written a whole book about the following, which is of which this is a very special case. I'm engaged in teaching, I'm engaged in learning, I'm engaged in something in life, it doesn't actually matter, but let's stick with teaching and learning. And something strikes me. Students aren't doing as well on these tests as I thought they might. Has that ever happened? something strikes you about what's going on. Students are sitting very passively, and I can't somehow get them active. So something strikes me. So I've noticed something. Something has come to my attention. So now what I want to do is to ask myself, what other actions could I try taking other than the ones that I'm using habitually? Because if I just go into the class and keep on doing the things I've been doing, I'm presumably going to keep on reproducing the same phenomena. And if there's something I'm not happy with, then I want to do a bit of work on it. This is the other meaning of critical, meaning there's room for improvement here, if just I can find it. So what do I need to change my teaching? I need two things. I need an alternative action to carry out, not the one that I use habitually. And secondly, what I need is to notice in the moment to act differently, because we have these habits which drive our behavior. And which, even though for example, for a number of years, I kept saying to myself, I'm going to use this particular little pedagogic strategy in the middle of this session. And I kept forgetting to do it. Does that happen to you? You forget to do what you meant to do? When you get to my age, it happens all the time. You go upstairs and you can't work out why you're upstairs, so you go back down again, and you can't remember why you're downstairs. Okay. This business of trying to remember, trying to be alert in the moment to act in a way that I'd like to prepare. And I've searched the literature high and low, east and west, and the only mechanism that I've come across is the following. If you want to change what you're doing, change a habit, then what you've got to do is A, pick an alternative action, B, imagine yourself as fully, vividly, emotionally, as well as physically, you're doing the action, feeling the desire to do the action, and actually the situation in which the action is taking place. You use all of the psyche, the body, the heart, and the mind. Are there any sense? Imagine yourself into the situation. That won't make it happen necessarily straight away. You've got to keep doing that. Keep doing that. And I call that the discipline of noticing. The discipline of noticing. Because I'm in a disciplined fashion, learn to notice an opportunity in the moment to act differently. And my guess is that you're going to just say, yeah, sure, I recognize that. Because it's an integral part, the sources from which I've got these ideas are from Sufism, and from Indian psychology, Samkhya philosophy, and from Zen Buddhism, and from Buddhism. That's where these ideas come from. They've been around for 4,000 or 5,000 years. My question is, why haven't we learned? Well, we don't learn from experience. That's one of the problems. Okay, so can I put you back onto this? For non-mathematicians, this may not be a very intriguing task. But some of us look at that and suddenly we go, hang on, does this work? Now what is the this? But that's a question students are asking in every lecture. What's the this that I'm supposed to be learning to do? I suspect that if you are attempting to make sense of this, then one of the things you're doing is you're picking out detail. You're discerning. It isn't just a whole bunch of numbers. They're specific numbers. And you're looking for relationships between them. Has anybody looked at the 30 at the top of the diamond? Yes? You've looked at the 30. So you pick that out as 30, not as 30, but as 30. And you know it's multiplication, so something inside you looks for something that ought to be 30 with multiplication. And eventually your attention ends up on a 6 and a 5.
Yep.
Am I right?
Yep.
You're looking for a relationship that links two things that you've discerned. Now, I can do it here, of course. Here's a 6. Can you see that one? And here's a 5. Is that where the 30 comes from?
It comes from
this 6.
Yes.
And this 5.
Yes.
Yeah? So it's not just any old 6. It's got to be 6 in a particular place. Okay. After that, things start to go. 6 times 5 is 30. Okay. What's a sensible thing to look at next? My hearing isn't good enough. I'm sorry. The next row down. So I can either say, well, I've explained 30. How about 24, 20? Or I can say, I've done 6 5s. Let's try 6 4s. Try the next one. What are 6 4s? 24. Is there a 24 nearby? Oh, okay. And if the 24 is 6 4s. What do you think the 20 is? 4 5. Not this, not 4 5, but 4 5. So let's run down this way. 30, 24. What about the 36? Where's that come from? Aren't you starting to feel a bit good about this? Because you're starting to make sense of it. You're using your natural powers mathematically to make sense of something that's mathematical. And you can do it. Even, may I say, I suspect some of you who think you're not mathematicians, because you're all mathematicians, you've just got to use your powers mathematically. That's what matters. So we've got, look at this, we've got 30, 24, 36, 54. What's 54? And, my arrow keeps going. And 42? 6 7s. So look, we've run a string of these. We've actually picked out a number of relationships between the things at the bottom in the diamond and the numbers along the top. And it's starting to be a property. If there was another number beside the 7, suppose it was another number there, where would you put 6 times it? In the middle, you'd make another row in here and stick it there, more or less. Yeah? You have shifted. You have engaged in that wonderful mathematical experience of shifting from recognizing relationships amongst particular things to perceiving a property which holds in lots of situations. Namely, this pattern's going to run. That's a form of generalization. Now, I think that's a very subtle shift. So what I'm trying to illustrate here is aspects of the movements of attention. You can run down this way, you can run the 20, the 16, the 24, the 36, the 28, lots of different ways of going at this, but that'll do for now. So let me just see what's... Yes. So one of the conclusions that I've come to, and it conforms with but slightly challenges traditional research in geometry, what a surprise, about attention, namely that sometimes you hold the whole, you just gaze at the whole diamond, sort of vaguely aware there are numbers but not really looking at anything in particular. I claim that's what you did at the beginning. Then you discern, there's a process of discerning details. I'm not saying, I don't mean then, I mean another way of attending is to discern details, to pick out details. Another way to attend is to look for relationships amongst the details that you've picked out. But you can't look for relationships amongst things you haven't picked out the detail of. Well, suppose you're a teacher and you're talking about the relationship between two details that you've picked out. But the students are trying to work out what details you're talking about. They haven't discerned those details for themselves. How can they hear what you have to say? you're attending to relationships, and they're attending to trying to find out where on the board your, the things are you're referring to. That happens in mathematics a lot, I confess. And a different way of thinking is to perceive properties, to see the relationships that you recognize as instances of a generality. And that's where the really significant learning takes place. And then in mathematics, we push things a bit further and we reason on the basis of agreed properties. That's reasoning with the axioms, that sort of thing. So this is what I call the microstructure of attention. And I'm now going to wrap up and yes. What do you see? Pac-Man! What else do you see? You see a triangle, don't you? Yes. Is there a triangle there? No. No, there's no triangle there. You're seeing a triangle. That's different. That's different. The ontology here is critical. Now, I think this is a lovely, it's a classic Gestalt exercise from the 1904, something like that.
Part of the circle.
Oh, I see, yes. Okay. Yep. I think it's a metaphor. It's an example of what happens when we try to listen to kids. We pick, a few things happen, and immediately we fill in all the detail. We classify someone, that was a really good question, that's a bright student. We just jump to conclusions. When we're doing research, we get some data, we pick out a little bit of detail from something in the data, and suddenly we're seeing a whole construct in mass education. The teacher says a couple of things, and we say, oh, that's scaffolding. Or zone of proximal development, or whatever construct we're currently thinking about. This is what our brains do. We've known that for a long time. One way of thinking about it is foregrounding and backgrounding, but that's just a bunch of words to explain it. The point is, it's a phenomenon. When you're examining teaching critically, one of the things you need to do is to be very careful that you're not filling in the triangle. In this sense, you're not adding things that actually aren't there. Have you got evidence that the whole what you're claiming is there really is there? Okay. No, I haven't got time for that. All right. Good. So, a scientific approach to teaching seems to me only to make sense. For me, this is my individual perspective. It only makes sense if I've already been critical about teaching. I've picked out some critical elements of teaching that I think are learning, that I think are critical, and I've raised questions about my practice. Then I can start being scientific about it. And I maintain that the discipline of noticing, which I wrote about, is actually a method for being scientific, maybe a bit hard, but it certainly is a research paradigm. It's a way of working, of researching. And so a scientific approach to teaching tries to bring to the surface and examine critically assumptions that are being made, whether it's about students or about the institution or the mathematics, about learning and doing mathematics, whatever it is. These assumptions that we fill in, just as in the Pac-Man triangle, as soon as something happens, we make a lot of assumptions. Trying to bring those assumptions to the surface. What's the best way to get kids to learn how to solve linear equations, get them to memorize something, that's a possibility. Get them to work on a set of exercises, that's another possibility. There are assumptions that we're all making. Bring to the surface personal habits. Bring to the surface things that I do habitually, and for that I probably need colleagues, somebody who says, do you know, by the way, that you're always scratching your left ear? Or, whatever it is. Lots of different things that we do as habits that might not be desirable. I'm willing to bet that at least several of you have picked out three that I have, and I have no idea what they might be. Okay. One of them might be, am I making sense? That's a soft phrase of mine. Am I making sense? And I've come to that one from trying various things, to ask people, try to get people to respond to me. Bringing you to the surface and examining, to examine critically by listening to students in particular. The whole notion of student voice is very popular at the moment. I'm nearly done, I think. I wanted to just observe the difference between assenting and asserting. Assenting means sitting back and waiting. Have you ever come across students who sit at the back of the lecture theatre, or the back of the class, and they go, yeah, I could have done that.
Yeah, sure.
Not actually participating, but just going along with what happens. And some of the time you've been assenting to what I've been saying. And I would like to get you to the point where you are now willing to make conjectures to each other by initiating action, which I'm going to ask you to do in a minute. And I've been talking about the difference between reacting and responding. To react is automatic and habitual. To respond involves taking in and making something sensible in reply, preferably by standing back from the action, like the adolescent, like the student who's doubting the mathematics, standing back and saying, is there a better way, is there an alternative action that I could employ? That's what I mean by responding. And I like all these re words in English, because they all mean to do it again, to act again the way I always do. To spond. Spond comes from the Italian spondere, and it means to be able to justify. So, reaction, I can't justify, it just happened. Responding, I can justify my choice of action. And I want these various things in mathematics are really important, and to contrast that with regurgitating. And I haven't had time to talk about it, but one of the major things that my wife and I offer is, in terms of getting responding rather than reacting by learners, is to get them to construct mathematical objects. But I haven't got time to go into that. I just mentioned, I don't think I've got noticing in here. No, I don't.
Can you explain the word regurgitating? That's not familiar.
Which one, sorry?
Regurgitating.
Oh. Goats. Think goats. Do goats have two stomachs? They eat grass, and then they bring it back up again and chew it. Cows certainly do that. You recognize what I'm talking about? But to regurgitate means to bring it back up again. So I tell you that that's a bit strong. It doesn't have to be quite as bad as vomiting. It means bringing it back up for consideration. Now, we did a very interesting shift here with Confucian culture and Malaysian, sort of all a mixture of all sorts of things, so I'm not very expert. But as my understanding, the Confucian culture, it's common to memorize things in order to bring them back and think about them, think them through. In the West, all we do is memorize, and people don't bother bringing them back up and chewing them over. The whole point of memorizing something is so you can chew it over. Okay, but in English, regurgitating is a negative. So I've just offered you the positive version of regurgitation. But in English, it's a negative thing. To regurgitate means, I tell you minus B plus, I tell you something in class, and then you write it on the exam. Right back. Just give it right back to me. I have some technical terms, and you just give me the technical terms right back again without making much sense. That's regurgitating. It hasn't passed through here at all. It's sort of within there and comes back out again. Whereas the positive version of regurgitating would be to take it in and then to re-examine, chew it over with all that metaphor, to think it through, what are the implications, and so on and so forth.
Is that accepting without question?
Yes, I mean that in the English usage, it would be accepting without questioning. Just your job is to tell me, and my job is to tell you back.
So this is a good example of where the teacher and student are not making much sense.
That's right.
They're not meaning the same thing.
They're not meaning the same things at all. I talked about babbling earlier, where the students are trying to make sense with technical terms but aren't not quite getting it right. You recognize that? You ever handed in a mathematics assignment, you know what I mean, because you're trying to get all the words in the right order, but sometimes it doesn't happen. That's babbling. But gargling is when you take technical terms and you just put them in a big sentence and hope they make sense on your essay for math for education. As a marker of education assignments and so on, I see a lot of gargling. I call it gargling because I'm just practicing. Just trying the technical terms out. And it's quite hard to tell the difference between a student gargling and a student babbling. Somewhere in the middle there's an overlap, and it's, you know, somebody's desperately trying to use zone of proximal development in an intelligent way, but it comes out and it's hard to know whether they're just using it or whether they're really trying to mean something. Okay, would you please humor me by asking yourself, is there something that has struck you that is, you know, of significance for you in what has happened this morning? Something you might like to work on or work, think about more, to regurgitate in the positive sense, not the negative sense. I hope there's something. Can you find something? And if you can find something, can you imagine yourself working on it, doing something with it? Try and imagine yourself. Put in there with a desire. I want to work on it. And imagine yourself in an appropriate place. Not while you're swimming or while you're, getting on the bus. What to you might be alright. A place where you could really work on it. Imagine yourself in that place, desiring to work on it, and how you'd like to work on it.
Those who are teaching, those who are teachers here or lecturing, I think they can have the opportunity to expand on what you have been saying.
And what I'm trying to do is to set up the possibility that you'll remember to try something like I'm talking about, because of that problem of we tend to forget. So I'm going to stop there and questions, at least one question.
Thank you so much. As a teacher, we would like to be critical thinking teacher, but sometimes students don't like be critical thinking students. As for example, by using your method, last method, I taught students. For example, I explained to you what is the difference, what is the similarity and something like that. After I explained some question by this, I want to promote mathematical thinking. After that, some excuse me teacher, is it possible you explain how we can solve this question? It's not the process of solving the question, it's the process of thinking. They want to just learn the rule. Just very quickly solve the question. That's my problem. The problem from some students, who don't like critical thinking and also mathematical thinking.
Okay, now let's try and find a positive way of framing that rather than a negative way. Dr. Rosalini's thesis is all about struggling with exactly this, and it is a huge struggle, and I recognize that. I recognize it fully, completely, and utterly. However, I ask myself, what is my responsibility? Is it to give them what they think they want? Or is it to offer the opportunity of something that's much better for them? Now, I'm not forcing myself on people, that's for sure. All I'm doing is offering an opportunity. And if they don't want to participate, that's their business, as far as I'm concerned. And yes, as I said at the beginning, the experience, the past experience is a huge factor. It's a critical factor in how people respond. The disposition that's been set up, the patterns of behavior. So what have I got to do? I've got to find some way to catch their attention, to give them a little bit of a taste of, oh, that was good. That tasted good. Now I'll go back and do what I was doing before. Oh, another taste. And slowly to build up that taste of, hang on, there's something more here. There's something more available. And you're not going to reach 90% of your students. No, you're not. Don't pretend you are. So don't try to make huge sweeping changes. Try and pick something. One of the techniques is 5 minutes at the beginning of every session, do something the way you want to do it, and then go back and do, you know, what they're expecting. And with any luck, after a while, they'll start saying, can we do a bit more of this? Can we do a bit more? Same and different. It's a classic example. It's been written up as a research paper. Starting off, it's a little bit of same and different, and after a while, the students say, can we do a bit more of same and different? Can we do one now in the middle of a lesson on, you know, some mathematical topic? You've got them. I didn't mean that in a negative way. There's some possibilities there. But you mustn't have expectations that if you walk in next tomorrow morning and do something completely differently, that the students will respond in the way you hope they will. No, they won't. Because they're so ingrained in the way that they're working. And poor Rosalind has struggled with this for many years. I'm not displaying this often any confidences or anything. But if you firmly believe that there's something critical in learning which really would benefit lots of people, then I think we have a responsibility for trying to move in that direction.
I think the good students who actually absorb the idea but not aware they're absorbing it do not want to stay on a subject the way we want, because they can understand. But the students who are not so good, after some time, they will enjoy doing it because they find that they understand better. So you cannot listen to the one that wants to go quick. But the one who wants to go quick means they haven't understood it. So maybe you have to challenge them, yes, question that, you know, that means that, you know. And then maybe you have to listen to the voices of the people who don't say anything. They don't say anything,
yes,
but
yes,
they are thinking in.
They're talking to each other. And
by either talking to each other or by giving in very poorly done work, mm-hmm, or not babbling or guzzling or whatever you call it. But when they have, yeah, very bad work, I mean, you need to pay attention to that.
Then, right.
And if like 50% of the class don't understand what they're doing, so I think we have a responsibility to attend to the 50% who don't understand it. It is not right that they come out of your class with no understanding at all of what they're supposed to do. And they go to be Napoleon teaching mathematics for engineers. How can they be engineers if they don't understand the things that they were teaching in class?
Yep. Please.
Okay, I think it is part of the Asian culture because we are not brave enough to challenge many assumptions. And I also have some difficulties at the beginning when I started in this university. And then the way that I always urge students is when they're writing the assignment, so I just tell them that I'm only working down actually. I ask them, you are an expert and you can make a summary or make some assignment, and then, you know, just you are already an expert and then you are responsible to do that. And then, of course, there are some process I have to criticize about their writing, and then there are some plagiarism you do. But at the end, I think the student will learn that, you know, they are already experts when they can produce something.
The most negative factor, the most negative critical factor, I think, conjecture, everything I say is a conjecture, don't believe me, but I think one of the major factors is students' self-confidence, students' sense of themselves. Like we call it identity now in math education. I have troubles with that for various reasons, going back to Stanford philosophy, but anyway, self-efficacy, the sense of myself. So it's really important to build that confidence. But you have to be careful how you do it. Giving people simple tasks doesn't achieve that, because they know they're simple tasks. So it's, I think the most effective thing is to awaken in them the use of powers, because it's pleasure. There's a little bit of pleasure. When you started to see the diagonal and the diagonal multiplication, just a little bit of pleasure. Just a little moment, a little frisson. There are things that give you more pleasure in life, but that wasn't bad. And those can build and build and build. And that's why I keep on doing mathematics all the time. I had a problem to work on in the car coming across, except I was trying to do the slides instead. But almost always I have a mathematics problem I'm working on, because I get real pleasure from being stuck. getting it out, I'm not sure what to do with it, because if I publish it, then it takes away the opportunity for other people to work on the same task. So I'm not quite sure. But being stuck on it and then saying, what about? Oh, no. What about? Oh, yeah. What about? It's great fun. It feels good. Sorry, that's just my view.
I think we have one more question.
Any more questions or comments?
I'm just wondering, during this generation, especially you're telling us just now, the youth in UK and Malaysia, or maybe in other parts of the world, it reminds me of, I think, what you're going to tell us, that they don't have the
If I had a way of resolving this issue of resilience again, when things aren't going exactly how I want it, not getting an instant response from my friends or from a problem or whatever, if I had an answer to that, a way of dealing with it, I could be rich and famous. I don't have an answer to it. But my suspicion is that human beings are going to go through some sort of a phase, and then it will sort of come out the other side. Because in order to survive as a group, as a community, human beings are going to need to do more than just instant responsibility. My son is involved in risk management, risk analysis, and some of what he has to do is just so fast on the telephone, buying and selling. But he also has to be thinking about what software does he need in order to make those decisions. And then he has to spend time actually building that software. So I think people are going to find out that we do need to persevere, to have resilience, to concentrate for periods of time. Let me give you a flip side of that. When my daughter was about this high, I guess, 9 or 10, something like that, she couldn't get through a meal at home without getting up from the table, going into the next room and doing a handstand against the door. She was just standing on her hands with her feet up. Now, it might be she had some gut problems. I don't know. She never said. But the point is, the point is that she would concentrate on doing that for a period of time. A better story. A school invited the kids to bring in something about a hobby that they had. They put out tables in the hall, and each child who wanted to brought in various things they collected or things, artifacts of what they did as a hobby. One boy said, "Can I have another table, please?" Okay. This is a boy who said almost nothing in class, who didn't perform very well, was considered to be a low attainer, not succeeding. Okay, I'm going to my version of this story, so you have to accept that. They brought the stuff in, and this boy brought clocks. He had two tables worth of clocks, watches, clocks, various sizes, and it turned out he made the clocks himself. The gears, everything. He'd also repaired a lot of clocks, so he had clocks that were working that hadn't previously worked. But he made some of these clocks. This boy was clearly attending for long, concentrating for long periods of time. Try making a gear out of a piece of metal. It's non-trivial. So it's where my attention gets attracted, I am willing to concentrate for long periods. So one of my ways of thinking about this is, can I make mathematics a domain in which at least some people feel the desire that maybe there's something here? And it's involved, you know, involves little steps, getting slightly harder problems, or something that just happens to intrigue. So I need to try what I would call a shotgun technique, lots of pellets, and hoping to catch, that something will catch. So that's a flip side, it's a hopeful side. But I'm afraid I'm mostly depressed, as I think you might be, about young people's concentration span. And I think human beings will come through. Otherwise we'll disappear, so one way or the other. I'm sorry, that's that can be.
I'm sorry, I think we have to stop here because our Prof mentioned time is very limited. He has to leave UTM by 3, but we have other plans for him after this. Okay, thank you for everyone, and especially to our guest speaker. Okay, we have something for him. Lee, can you get the UTM back? Okay. So I think it has been a rewarding experience to all of us, and don't be surprised that I will adopt his tactics next week in our So we have started not this much more for you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, from the bottom
of the I was making you work. I think you worked at least as hard as I did. Can I apologize that some of the slides didn't come up in the right order? I didn't have time to review them and sort them out. But I'll make sure they're correct, and I'll leave them here before I go this afternoon.
Okay, we will distribute prompt message slides to everyone. Okay? So we have some refreshment out there, and maybe we can mingle around.